Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, buddy. Today on Basic, Pauly Shore.
Well, it was at the beginning of 12th grade. The teachers were passing back the SAT papers, you know, which is this college pamphlet. And I just knew then, like, shit, now life's going to get serious and I got to figure this out. My friends would call me the weasel. And then I always said, well, if a weasel could make a noise, what would the weasel noise sound like? And I'll be like, you know, I came up with that noise. And then I think the first word that I paused was major. So for instance, like I say, check out the video, it's gonna be major. And then from there, I just started pausing in between grind, ditch, body. And I just started, and it just was this cadence that I created, I think, on the air. It wasn't manufactured.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to Basic, the official podcast of the unofficial history of cable television. I'm Doug Herzog, a former TV executive, and I'm going to try not to get Jen too edged today.
And I'm Jen Chaney, TV critic at Vulture and New York Magazine, and I'm not the weasel, but I have always aspired to be.
In a time before TRL and MTV's turn to reality television, there was a show called Totally Pauly, which was MTV's afternoon comedian VJ who caught the imagination of MTV's after-school audience in a big way.
The Weez seemed to come out of nowhere and became a huge MTV star, later going on to star in 5 feature films. No one who lived through the 90s could possibly forget Pauly Shore.
Nope, not at all. He was truly iconic in his own way, and he's still around today touring the country, and I'm sure he's still chilling and grinding. So stay tuned for our conversation with the Weez and hang around after as Jen and I get totally Pauly.
Well, we are very, very excited to welcome Pauly Shore to the Basic podcast. Welcome, Pauly.
Basic meaning like I'm fucking basic, or is it
no.
Basic?
Basic cable,
dude.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm just kidding. This is the basic. Everyone's fucking basic on here. No, I'm just kidding. Thank you for having me. You know, anytime, you know, Doug Herzog reaches out, whether it's for a new liver or, you know, some sort of, you know, some sort of blood transfusion or to be on his show. Of course, I come. Doug is he's my brother. So.
He asked you for a liver too. God damn it. Unbelievable.
Yeah. And some money.
It's all those MTV parties that we had for many years. What a run we had, huh?
That was a good time. We'll get to that.
What a fucking run.
But Jen's got our first question for you.
Yeah, we have a question that we traditionally ask first of all of our guests, which is, do you remember when you first got or saw cable television?
The first time I got or saw cable television, I mean, I guess it was CNN, right? Were they the first ones that kind of...
One of them, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it was probably CNN. It was Jane Fonda's dude. What's his name? Ted Koppel?
Ted Turner.
And yeah, it was pretty awesome. I mean, it was you know, they were had different reporters all over the world. I remember like they were tear down this wall. You know, you had Ronald Reagan, and they had all that. And then you know it was cool. I mean, I love Dan Rather, and I love all those guys that used to be on there. And it was pretty cool. I remember. And then you know. Yeah, of course. It was.
What was the over under on the answer to that question being CNN versus MTV, Jen? What do you think?
I don't know. I'm
think
surprised.
CNN was first, right?
They definitely were first.
Yeah.
They were first.
That makes sense.
There you go.
So CNN was cool. You know, it was. I used to watch with my mom a lot. You know, the late great Mitzi Shore.
So speaking of your mom, you grew up in Los Angeles, in a real showbiz family, right? Your dad was a stand-up comedian. Your mom was the late, very great Mitzi Shore, who ultimately owned and ran the Comedy Store to great, great success, launching all kinds of stars.
I have a great photo of me, you, and her in the hallway right behind the original room. It's pretty awesome.
I would love to see that. I remember going up to her office to see her.
It was cool, you know? It was cool. It was like we were all hanging out, yeah.
She loved you so much. Yeah. So was there ever any question, given all that, that you weren't going to go into showbiz?
Well, I mean, you were there when I first started. So, I mean, you gave me my first break. So, I don't know. I mean, I just, you know, I was in awe of the comedians. I would follow them around, you know, when George Carlin was there or fucking Red Fox was there back in the 70s or Lenny Schultz. You know, a lot of these kind of these guys would run around. I was, you know, I saw, you know, Gallagher just passed away.
Never underestimate the appeal of a man smashing watermelons, Paul.
Yeah. Yeah. So he was there and it was just, I don't know, my brothers and my sister didn't get into it. They weren't really, you know, in awe of the comedians, like a comic, you know, when Robin and all these people would come in, I would follow them around like a little baby, you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, do you remember, were there specific things like either advice they gave you or just things you picked up on from watching them that you kind of tried to model your own approach?
Yeah, I remember watching Richard Pryor a lot, and I remember watching Sam Kennison a lot. And the thing that I really took from them that I learned from them is to kind of, I don't want to say kill the audience with kindness. They would always, because those two guys especially, as you remember, they were very blue, they were very raunchy, and they'd kind of be very dirty, but there was something so vulnerable and likable and sweet about them. Once they hit the stage, you never kind of knew, and immediately you love them. So that was kind of like the one thing that I really learned from them, is to kind of kill them with kindness and kind of get into them first before you start smashing them with your jokes. Mm-hmm.
So Sam, he was kind of a mentor to you, right? You were really, and to hear, you know, I think at least of people who didn't know Sam Kinison, which is probably most of the listening audience, to hear the word kindness associated with Sam Kinison is probably not something that, you know, people would draw a straight line between. So
I think the words,
what was it about Sam that drew you to him, and also like that kind of kept him, you know, interested in you?
He was very likable. So when I say kindness, I think the word's called likable. So he was very likable on stage. So when he hit the stage, there was something that was very kind of endearing, and but it was sinister too. And then he would kind of come out with the screaming and all that after. But I don't know. I mean, even if you watch his first Letterman, he came out on stage, you know, there was a smirk about him. He was charming.
But man, when he got going, it was like, get out of the way.
Yeah. Once he got going, then that's another thing. But, I don't know. And then I loved Robin Williams's kind of his ability to improvise, which was just fucking remarkable, because he would, you know, I remember the mom's, what was it like? I think the 15th Comedy Store anniversary at the Universal Amphitheater. And I remember Robin Williams just going on stage and pretty much improvising his whole act in front of, you know, 6,000 people.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because he came from that kind of that improv background. So all these different guys were just so remarkable. Yeah.
Yeah. And Robin he wasn't always yelling the same way that Sam was, but he definitely had super high energy.
Crazy
and
energy.
Just such a very fast brain. Yeah. And also a very kind person from everything I understand.
Yeah.
So what was the moment where you decided, okay, I'm actually going to try to get up on stage and do this? What was the turning point?
Well, it was at the beginning of 12th grade. Uh-huh. The teachers were passing back the SAT papers, you know, which is the college pamphlet. And I just knew then, like, shit, now life's going to get serious and I got to figure this out. So that was kind of when I decided, it was at the beginning of 12th grade, to start doing my stand-up.
I was just thinking on this now, like at that point in your life, you're a 12th grader, you're a kid basically.
Yeah, I'm 17,
And you're watching, for most of your young adult life, you're watching the greatest stand-up comedians of a generation on stage every night at the club and sometimes hanging around your house. Right. And you decide, I want to do that too. Was that the bar for you? You're like, I want to be Richard Pryor one day. I want to be Robin Williams one day. I want to be.
I don't know. I definitely had a lot of extra pressure being Mitzi's kid, because, you know, she was two people to me. She was my mom. You know, you want to please your mom, and then you want to kind of get by Mitzi Shore. So it was like a double, you know, it's a double whammy. So as far as the bar is concerned, I don't know. Comedy isn't something you choose. It chooses you. So, you know, as a kid, you know, I was always, I don't want to say funny, but I was always fucking around and I was always goofing off. So, you know, yes, it definitely helped that I was around it, but it's inside of me. I mean, here I am to this day, I'm 54 and I'm still doing shit, you know, just like it was my first.
Right.
Well, I think someone said to me, I'm going to be like George Burns, where I'm going to die with a microphone in my hand at 98 or some shit. Like, I just love it. And I think that's the key. You know, people always ask me about the business and I'm like, yo, it's got to get you out of bed. You can't be motivated by the money. Even when we worked for MTV, it was such an exciting time for me because I think I got paid $1,200 a week. I think it was 5 days.
You got paid in other ways.
What does that mean?
Nobody had more fun on MTV than Paulie Shore. He had the full MTV experience. And we'll get to that. But before we leave your early years, what did mom think when you told her, like, hey, I want to do this?
Any kid that wants to do something that their parents don't want them to do, there is an immediate kind of rub. So with me and mom, when I first started, she wanted me in college. She like didn't care if I did it, but she was nervous. And so I had a gun in my head regarding like, oh, I got to do this fucking quick. Because like, if I embarrass her, it is a blessing and a curse, you know, the MTV thing, because my career was actually on the way to just acting. I was acting a lot after high school, way before MTV. I would get dramatic roles on this and that. And then MTV came, and that just took off. And then from there, that's when Jeffrey Katzenberg got a hold of me. And that's when I did my movies in the 90s, all of those films. So if it wasn't for MTV, I wouldn't be doing all those movies. But you never know. I could have won an Oscar. You know what I mean? Because I was just acting. But right. I became known as this situation, you know, which is where we're at.
I was going to ask you, you know, you mentioned that you were getting some acting roles before MTV came along. At that point, was your thought process like, oh, I'm actually going to pursue acting. Like, this is what I'm going to do.
I loved acting and I love acting. I mean, to me, if you were to ask me what my favorite part of the arts is, whether it's stand-up or podcasting or, you know, or singing, or I would have to say acting. You know, I'm an actor first and foremost. When I go on tour and I sell tickets, it's not because of my Netflix special. It's not because of my Comedy Central special. It's because I starred in all these movies. Mm-hmm. And also the MTV stuff didn't help either, because the show kind of connected me with America in a way that no one else did. There was a connection that I had with the audience that no one else did. Mm-hmm. And it's to this day. I mean, people still feel like I'm that guy. You know, yo, what's up, bro? Because when I talked into the camera, I treated the camera as it's my homie, my buddy. Yo, come here, you guys, let's check this out. You know?
Also, you were out on the streets with them every day. It's part of your show. I mean, you were really touching the audience every day in the flesh.
Yeah. You know, if you look at the old Totally Paulies, it was the beginning of that whole genre of, you know, of reality. But it was kind of like a combo. Like Doug said, I was on the streets. I mean, we did a thing. First, it was around L.A. It was in the streets of L.A. And then I came to Doug and Joel Gallen. And I said, hey, we should get me out to America. And then that's when we did the 10 Reasons to Sponge, which was a contest where people wrote in 10 reasons why I should come sponge off of them. And they would write in and, you know, they would have a letter and it would say like, oh, my name is Cammie and please come to my house because, you know, there's this cool pizza parlor or, you know, I have a bowling alley. And I would literally show up, and Paul Cockrell and Carol Donovan and Greg Johnson were great producers. And we just did it. And it was just, you know, and that's
Tony DeSantis.
Tony would produce like he'd produce out in New York when I came to New York.
What did you call Tony? You had a nickname for him. I'm trying to remember what it was.
That bastard.
That's true.
That's awesome.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
In terms of your weasel persona, the whole vibe you had going, where did that come from? Where did that idea originate?
I kind of talk about that old Reese's peanut butter commercial where you kind of put the peanut butter with the fucking chocolate and you eat it, and somehow it just happened. It was kind of a natural thing. My friends would call me the weasel, and then I always said, well, if a weasel could make a noise, what would the weasel noise sound like? And I'll be like, you know, I came up with that noise. And then I think the first word that I paused was major. Mm. So for instance, like I say, check out the video, it's going to be major. And then from there, I just started pausing in between grind, ditch, body. And I just started, and it just was this cadence that I created, I think, on the air. It wasn't manufactured.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't like in like Pee Wee Herman where, you know, or it's Paul Rubens where it's like, oh, I'm Paul Rubens over here. And then now there's this character over here. It's something right. That just kind of, I started wearing my mom's clothes and I put a scarf on my head like Steven Tyler. And I'm like, those boots look cool. And it just, and I'm going to paint my Jeep purple. You know what I mean? It just kind of happened. Oh, here's my headshot. Check me out. I'm an actor.
Yeah. I think that's one of the reasons why you really connected with the audience. A, you were probably the same age. Mm. And also it felt authentic. Like it didn't feel like a character. Mm-hmm. It felt, or even an extension, it felt like this is who this guy is, at least at that moment. Right. And it really, I mean, it, you know, look, you know, if you were there in the early 90s and you saw this, you would remember how in what a big way Paulie Shore connected with the MTV audience and ultimately all of America through feature films and other things.
Now here I am sitting in my multi-million dollar house. No, I'm just kidding.
And I'm in my closet, Paulie. So
that's you should have taken some ownership in my shows.
There you go.
No, I'm just kidding. fucking Rotenberg, dude. Where's that guy?
Crisco?
Where's Crisco?
Crisco. Let's go back. I'm trying to actually remember how you ended up on MTV. Now, tell me if this tracks. What I remember was you showing up at spring break, a woman named Drew Wilson, who was an MTV talent coordinator, who was she was the first person that ever said to me, Paulie Shore. And I remember, I think she flew you down to Daytona, if I'm not mistaken, to put you on during spring break. Is that how it started?
Yeah, what happened was, is my manager brought in Drew. I guess she had heard about me through Hollywood. You know, Hollywood's a small town. So, like, they were starting to hear about, like, who's this kid, da-da-da-da-da. So she had seen me at the Comedy Store. I showcased for her. And then after, she's like, yo, you want to come to spring break for MTV? And I was like, yeah, I would love to. I'd be honored. That'd be beautiful. So then, yeah, 3-4 months later, she flies me down there and I wind up sharing a hotel room with Christian Slater. Because he's down there promoting Gleaming the Cube. Remember nice. Gleaming the Cube?
And of course, we're too cheap to get everybody their own hotel room.
Yeah. And
that's, come on, guys. making them bunk up. That's ridiculous. Anyway, sorry.
No, it was cool.
I remember Adam Sandler sharing a room with Mario Joyner next to me one year.
Yeah.
Like, you know, again, we just, you know, it's just how
it was fun, though. It was cool. We didn't care. No one cared. Yeah. And then, yeah, so that was the first time. Yes. Was in, I think it was 1989. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I remember we were kind of, I would say, honestly, sort of mildly interested. And then what happened again? Tell me if this tracks. We did a comedy concert out in Pepperdine, where we, you know, we had been doing the half hour comedy hour, which was a big hit on MTV. It's like, well, let's just do a comedy concert like HBO. And we took like five comedians we liked, and we, you know, they're all going to give them like 15 minutes. But you opened up, you were the warm up, and you got out there and warmed up the crowd. And Joel Gallen, who now, you know, longtime VMA producer and Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and all the big shows, MTV's Unplugged, he came back, he shot the show and directed it. And he came back and he said, you need to look at this. Pauly Shore was the warm-up guy, and he killed, and nobody was funnier after that. And do you remember that night?
I remember it, yep.
And that was, I think, when we all took a look at that tape of you just warming up the crowd, and everybody's like, well, maybe this guy should have his own show.
Yeah, yeah. So that's exactly what happened. So you guys said to me, you said, yo, we want you to host this show called Five Funny Guys. And I said, well, that's great. And then you said, well, here's the thing. You're not one of the five funny guys. but you can host it and you can keep the tape. I'm like, fuck you. Let's go. So I was like, let's go. And then we did it and it went well. And then from there, I started guest VJing at night. Whenever you said, you go, yo, Nick, you told Rotenberg, anytime I come to town, you're welcome to guest VJ. And then after that, we did those vignettes, those 30-second vignettes, which was where I play a gangster, a real estate agent, and a football player. And it was kind of like my version of Randy the Redwoods. Remember?
Right, right. Yeah, sure.
And it's at the end, it said totally MTV. And then there were like 30-second vignettes that we shot on film. And then from there, those started airing in rotation. And then after that, you guys offered me a three-month kind of trial run.
Can you remember any particular guests or interactions you had with people that just worked really well, that stand out in your mind?
I mean, the Richard Pryor fucking interview was pretty cool. You know what I mean? I was able to get to him because of my relationship with him and through my mom in the store. Mm-hmm. So I got him right before he started getting sick. Mm-hmm. So I was able to like literally film like a whole week with him, you know, almost 35 segments.
Wow.
Wow.
I was like, cause that's how we filmed it. We would bang out 35 seconds segments in one day, and then I would switch my wardrobe. But you know, there was you know, there was Flea from the Chili Peppers, there was Keanu Reeves, there was, I don't know, you know, Alice Cooper, that shit was classic. There mm-hmm. was the guys from Warrant, that was really cool.
Yeah, you were also on MTV during like the hairband era, and you kind of had were running sort of parallel to what those guys were doing in a certain way. Did you feel like a heavy metal star at the time?
I think it was a combo. It was a combo of that and then grunge. I think the cool part about me is when the grunge came, you guys kept me on the air, which was kind of cool because that was a big, you know, that was a big shift.
Yeah, you had to go to the plaid shirts though after that. No more your mother's blouses.
Yeah. But yeah, it was a, you know, but I grew up on the Sunset Strip. So I was, I guess, more heavy metal because, you know, as a kid, my mom would always drive by the Rainbow right on Sunset to go home to Doheny and Sunset. And we'd always drive by, you know, all the heavy metal kids with, you know, they all look like they all.
Gazaris.
Gazaris. Yes. Gazaris. And in that area, you know, so I was very influenced by, you know, the Strip, you know. That's
fine. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, there's a clip of you interviewing a very, very, very young Bruno Mars that has gotten like new life on the internet. Do you remember that conversation at all? He was like five or something.
Oh, really?
And you could just see already he had so much talent. It's kind of crazy.
Well, what happened on that one, it was either Tony DeSanto or Bobby Moore, whoever was producing my Chilling with the Weeze show or whatever I was fucking filming down there. I had just finished rapping and they basically said, yo, you got to meet this kid. He does a perfect Elvis Presley impersonation. And I'm like, awesome. Let me meet him. And then we just filmed right there. I just said, roll, let's start rolling. And then he started doing Elvis Presley, and he started kind of doing moonwalks like Michael Jackson. And that never aired. That was just for like, you know, just for, you know, MTV's kind of like, you know, just because the camera was right there. But it was mostly like, once he started doing that, I'm like, we got to roll on this guy. And then obviously find out later is Bruno Mars. Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah. It's very cute. If you've never seen that clip, go look it up on YouTube.
Yeah, I go find that now. So you're this kid who's growing up in the, you know, around this comedy club. You decide to make it a career. You get going, you get on MTV, you get acting gigs. Then the next thing you know, you're doing feature films. So success came pretty big and pretty quick at you.
Yeah.
How did that impact you? How old were you when you were making those movies? You're still in your early 20s, right?
All my 20s. You know, again, I talk about it on my one-man show. I felt like Charlie from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. I truly felt like, you know, I got the golden ticket. I mean, being on MTV and then going into these films, I was, you know, that's why I was like, I was on Joe Rogan, I don't know, it was a year or two, I don't know, it was a while back. And I'll say this to you guys, you know, when I see my movies, I kind of get sad. And he's like, why do you get sad? I'm like, because that was like the happiest time in my life. And like, you're not happy now. I'm like, yeah, I'm happy. There's happy times. But at that time, I mean, dude, it was like fucking, you know what I mean? In your 20s, you know, and you're starring in movies and you're on tour and you're doing HBO and you're doing albums. And I was doing all these things that no one else was doing. And I was in heaven. So yeah, I was like, it was the most beautiful time. And my mom was there and she accepted me because a lot of, you know, the pressure was put on me to make it because I was Mitzi's kid. So I can't embarrass her. So I was like this, you know, like this to try to make it. And then once I made it, then all of a sudden my mom's like, oh, I'm so proud of you. Da, 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 you know? So yeah. So it was a special time. You know, it was a very special time.
That's a big burden to carry around, the expectation of, you know, being Mitzi's kid. When you first decided to jump on stage, did you do it at the Comedy Store or did you go someplace else? Did you feel like, or you know, how did that work? Because that feels like a big decision to me.
No, I stayed away for 2 years at least. Mm-hmm. You know, I worked the Laugh Factory. I worked the LA Cabaret. I went to Catch a Rising Star. I worked everywhere else but the Comedy Store. And then when I showcased for her, that's the name of my play. It's called Stick with the Dancing. So when I showcase for her, she's sitting in between Paul Mooney and Louis Anderson. And she's got her lineup there. And she's like, who's next? And Paul Mooney's like, Paul is next. She's like, oh, fuck, give me a cigarette. So then I do my show. And then I, you know, I do the jokes that the other comedians wrote for me. And then I end with pop locking. And then I said, how did I do? She said, stick with the dancing. That's what she said.
Hence the title of your show.
Yeah, hence the title of my show. So, yeah, so then the tension built. And then I started hanging out with Sam Kennison a lot and Rodney Dangerfield. And I got my own place at 19 years old. And that's when I started acting, you know, at 19. I started landing roles. A lot of roles, guest leads on this, boom, boom, boom. I started making my own money. And then MTV hit. And then eventually she was like, all right, you can come back in the house now. You know what I mean?
This is just a side note to the acting. When you were doing those acting roles, were you like, did you have like a different look? Was it like a more sort of conventional look than the one we would know you from today?
Correct.
Like shorter hair and collared shirts and like
I was just I still dressed the same way, but this was pre-Weeze, you know. Yeah. This is before the Weeze was even developed, you know. I mean, you got to understand something from 17, 18, 19, 20. I mean, it took me 5 years to like hit, right? So that's pretty quick.
That's very quick.
That's quick,
especially for somebody so young.
Yeah, that's quick.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's good. It's good and bad because, you know, it's good because I was able to experience, but it was bad because I didn't get to develop. You know what I mean? Didn't get to develop slower the way the normal person. I mean, Jon Stewart, when I was on MTV, I don't want to say he wasn't anything, but.
He wasn't.
Yeah, he was. he
wasn't Jon Stewart yet.
No, he was trying to figure it out.
His show, his MTV show didn't come on until after yours, right?
Correct. Yeah. And it just wasn't that good. It was just kind of like, it wasn't his voice. And until you put him on The Daily Show on Comedy Central, he became fucking massive. And I'm like, wow, like, I guess he's into politics. Because he wasn't. He wasn't into that shit when we were fucking around.
No, no. I mean, the Jon Stewart show, you know, I think he was trying to do his MTV version of Letterman back then, and it was not political right at all.
No, it was just a goofy show, yeah.
So, I mean, Paulie, if you could go back, would you do anything differently during that era than what you did?
I mean, my come from is I love to work. You know, I don't come in anything going, oh, you know, I don't. At least back then, I'm like, oh, if I do this, then it's going to fuck up that. You know, I didn't think like that. I was just so joyful and so excited to star in movies and to do stuff. So I wasn't really coming from a place of strategy.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, if I was thinking straighter, I would probably not have done a lot of the things that I've done. I did. But at the time when I did it, that's kind of how I felt. You know, mm-hmm. Jury Duty was like it wasn't a hit for me, or Biodome wasn't a hit for me at the time. You know, you could say they're a hit now, which they are. You know, they're like these cult classics.
Classics, yeah.
Yeah, but at the time, they didn't perform. But a lot of it has to do with the fact that I was so over popular, or what's it called? Over
saturated.
Saturated, that like enough of this guy already. I was becoming punchlines on people's shows. So to answer your question is like the smarter thing to have done is probably stopped after Son-in-Law and just taken a break and kind of like start to, while my stock was high, play the game more. But again, young guy, millions of dollars they're offering me. Hey, you know what? We'll make it work. This is a funny idea. You know, let's all figure this out. And unfortunately, that shit sometimes doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Right.
It's hard to see, you know, you're so enveloped by it. It's hard to see where it all goes and how it goes. And but that being said, you know, a lot of the projects you have been doing over the last couple of years, including the one-man show you have referenced a couple of times, are pretty self-reflective. So can you talk about that a little bit? Is this a form of like, you know, kind of coming to terms with where you've been and what you've done? Or how do you look at that stuff?
Well, I'm very self-aware. I've always been very self-aware of where I'm at.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think, why I did Paulie Shore is Dead, which to me was the best movie that I've ever done because it was so therapeutic. And, you know, everyone was in it, from Sean Penn. I mean, I don't want to go down the list, but it was the beginning. It was Curb before Curb.
Mm.
You know, Paulie Shore is Dead. If you haven't seen this, it's like, what the fuck? You know, it's pretty remarkable what I pulled off. So I was very, you know, when you know, I fired Rotenberg and CAA and Bennett and all those guys, and I kind of spit myself out on the street. I did that kind of in a way because I just didn't feel joy anymore. I just felt like I was turning 30, you know what I mean? And I was like, I was burnt out. And then I went to group therapy and self-help and all these things to kind of just try to let go of everything that I had been through so I can move forward at 30. And once I got through that, I was able to kind of smile at the wheeze and smile at what I did. And that's where I wrote Paulie Shore is Dead. And to me, Paulie Shore is Dead was the beginning part of the second part of my career. So like Doug said, you know, all the stuff I've been doing the last 20 years, you know, it's all kind of self, you know, whether it's Adopted, you know, whether it's Vegas is My Oyster or Paulie, all these projects that I did for Showtime or different specials, you know, I wouldn't have been able to do those, I don't think, if I didn't spit myself on the street. But if I would have stayed with Rotenberg, I could have been Howie Mandel. You know what I mean? And Howie's had a great career. You know, here's a guy that's hasn't stopped working since Deal or No Deal.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean, that's great, but it's a different path for everybody. And you know, yeah. What I would say, Paulie is a guy who's known you a long time, mm-hmm. and you know, and I know the story, and you know, to hear how you talk about it, and you know, realizing that you needed to kind of, as you say, spit yourself onto the streets and figure it out. You feel to me like in 2022, as a guy who's really comfortable with who he is, what he does, how he does it. I think that's a good place to be, whoever you are.
Yeah. So. No, I'm, Yeah, no, I know. It, again, going back to, you know, I love to work and thank God for the internet. I can create my own stuff now. Mm-hmm. We can all create our own stuff. You know, you don't need anyone to do what you guys are doing. So I'm all right.
Yeah, I think the internet has been really cool for you as a guy who's always been kind of really in touch with his audience, going back to the MTV mm-hmm. days. Were you on the streets with them? Because I follow you on Twitter, and I see, you know, I see the back and forth, and I just think it's like, I think that's a great thing for Pauly Shore. Like you're still literally in touch with your fans every day who want to be in touch with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's you know what, you know, being 54 and all this death around me, you, everyone. In our mm-hmm. age, the end of the day, I talk to comedians every day. Every day someone dies. I mean, you know, these comics with Gallagher and Judy Tenuta and you know, and you just go down the list. Like, this is life, Doug. You know, boom, boom, boom. It's quick. You know, all of a sudden we're older and it's just a fast thing. So, you know, you definitely want to look. For me, I want to try to look about what I have, not what I don't have. And, you know, your health is the most important thing, I think. Sounds corny, but you know, fuck.
But all of them, Gilbert, Bob Saget, you know, mm. Norm, like all of them, I promise you, they all wish they'd go on stage tonight. Every one of them. Mm. Every one of them. Yeah. So.
I mean, are there things that you still want to do that you haven't done yet? Or is there a particular project that you're working on that you're trying to get off the ground that's kind of really motivating you right now?
Yeah, I'm doing, you know, as this business, you always do several things at once.
Right.
So the one man show is important to me. It's very exhausting, but it's therapeutic and people really seem to be responding to it. So I'm working on that. Also a memoir. I've been working on that for a while. So I'm going to self-publish that and put that out there. And then also I'm making a deal with Adam Sandler's company right now for a scripted version of my show, which is kind of like, which is like Everybody Hates Chris or The Wonder Years. So it's going to cast a Pauly in their, you know, Pauly like in their from 14 to 18. And I would kind of do the VO, do the voiceover. So it'd be, you know, Pauly going around Beverly Hills High School and then back at the Comedy Store. But like kind of really harsh and kind of like edgy, mm-hmm. like it was. So I'm happy working with Adam on that.
We're going to wrap up here with our traditional final question, which is, other than your own show, Totally Pauly, and any other associated shows you've done, what is your all-time favorite basic cable show?
Mm, my all-time favorite basic cable on MTV?
Sure. What's your favorite MTV show? Let's keep it. Wait,
okay, the cable show. I mean, I love the Chris Rock show. That was fucking awesome on HBO.
Well, sure.
That's premium cable.
Forgot about that. That's a good poll.
Remember, that was such a good show when he had those high...
Short-lived talk show.
Yeah, he had the high chairs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He would come out and he would do that. But, you know, probably Chappelle. That was obviously great. But I'd have to say my favorite cable shit. Let me see.
We'll take Chris Rock or Chappelle.
Yeah. Chris Rock or Chappelle. Yeah.
All right. Well, Pauly, we appreciate you being here. It's great to see you. Everybody should check out, first of all, go on YouTube, check out Bruno Mars. but also go find Pauly Shore is Dead, which is a great watch. And if you get the chance, go check out his one-man show. Are you going to tour that at some point?
I've been touring it. Yeah, I've been touring it. So I'll be at the Comedy Store. Yeah, I'll be at the Comedy Store November 30th. I also have a band. I joined a band, which is pretty funny. It's called Pauly and the Crusties. And it's basically me with these senior citizens playing behind me. And it's actually really fun. It's on YouTube. And then I also have my my podcast that I just started with Jam in the Van, which is a really great YouTube channel, which is it really reminds me, Doug, of old how MTV started, you know, or Funny or Die, where it started before it popped, you know?
Right.
And it's just all music. And so it's me just interviewing musicians.
That's great.
And it's really cool. So it's on Jam in the Van and you can see me interview just musicians. And it's pretty cool.
Well, you can check Pauly Shore out almost everywhere these days. Thank you, Pauly. We appreciate it. And it's great to see you, buddy.
Later. Bye.
Thank you, Pauly.
All right. Pauly Shore, the Wheeze was here. How did that go for you, Jen?
You know, one of the things that struck me about that conversation is, you know, a lot of times people assume that if you have relatives in show business, parents, what have you, that you already are at an advantage and it's just going to make everything easier for you. And it was really interesting to hear him talk about the flip side of that, which is, yeah, he obviously was exposed to Richard Pryor and Robin Williams and all these great comedians, but there was this sense of like, if I get out there and start trying to be a comic, to be an actor, and I screw up, it's going to be a huge embarrassment for my mother. And so that's a different kind of pressure that I think a lot of times people just think, oh, you're a Nepo baby. Everything works out for you. And I think it's a little more complicated than that.
I think it is for sure. It's a real burden to a certain extent. And also in the business he was in, his mom theoretically, you know, could do things for him. But at the end of the day, he's going to get up on stage and win over an audience.
Right.
And that's where the rubber meets the road. And he ultimately did that. I can remember, you know, we talked a little bit about this. I remember when he came to Spring Break, and this woman was very much, to her credit, Drew Wilson, who was an MTV talent executive. Fun fact, she was also Johnny Carson's assistant.
Oh.
So she'd kind of grown up around the Tonight Show. She had a great eye for comedians, honestly. She was the first person ever to say Jerry Seinfeld to me.
Mm.
Like early 90s, late 80s, can't remember, certainly pre the show. Anyway, she brought Paulie down and everybody was kind of rolling their eyes. You know, it was like, oh, he's somebody's kid. And Drew was pushing him pretty hard. And it really wasn't until that following thing that we talked about where he actually got up in front of an audience and killed, where we all started to sit up and pay attention. And then everything didn't really matter. It's like, wow, this guy can get in front of an audience and he's got something and they seem to respond. And maybe we should be in business with him.
Yeah. And I was thinking too, when you guys were talking about just his persona on camera, on MTV, on Totally Pauly, and like on one hand, it was a persona, on one hand, it kind of wasn't because it felt like him. And I think he was just very natural on camera. Like he was saying, he just pretended like he was talking to people. And you really did, even if you weren't conscious of it, when you watch him, you do feel that. Like it felt like he was talking to you personally.
I think that's right. He really had a great way in front of the camera and with his audience. And again, it wasn't too scripted or hardly scripted at all. So he was allowed to be himself and he was, and it just, you know, it was one of those things that worked. You know, you can never predict these things. And it was a time, it was a place. He was the right guy at the right time on MTV. You know, he had a little bit of that heavy metal thing. You know, he had a little bit of the surfer dude thing. He was funny and he, I don't know, he just tied it all together. He was, again, it's hard to imagine what a big star Pauly Shore was in the early 90s, but big enough to star in 5 feature films.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think it's great that he's still, you know, so active, so engaged, doing a lot of different things. And from what he said, clearly wants to get back into acting and maybe even some serious acting, which may sound weird to some people, but I really would be interested to see him in a movie with Nick Cage.
I would too. And it wasn't until doing research for this that I realized how much acting he had done previously.
Mm-hmm.
And then to hear him talk about, you know, how important that was to him and how that's what he kind of really wanted to do. So I'd be curious to see him in a role. And I really sort of appreciate the stuff he's doing now, which is, you know, sort of very self-aware, you know, very kind of reflective. And, you know, I think he's in a good place. He knows who he is. He knows who the audience is. They still want to see him, which I think is great. And he's still out there doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a good conversation. I'm glad we had him on.
Yeah, me too. So some quality time with the Wheeze. We hope you enjoyed it. And we hope you'll join us next time on Basic.
Basic is a Pantheon Media production in partnership with SiriusXM.
Hosted by Jen Chaney
and Doug Herzog.
Produced by Christian Swain and Peter Ferrioli.
Lindley Ehrlich is our assistant producer.
Sound design and music by Jerry Danielson.
Mixed and mastered by Brian Slusher.
Recorded and edited by Zach Spisner.
You can find Basic on Apple Podcasts, the SiriusXM app, Pandora, Stitcher, or wherever you like to listen. If you like the show, please rate, review, and share so other people can find us.
Don't forget to follow the show so you never miss an episode.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's fantasypoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. Fantasypoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.